Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Wednesday. It's noon Central, 11 Mountain, and it's time for the Dakota Political Junkies to join us. Today, we welcome Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader. He's on the phone from Sioux Falls. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Lori.
Also with us, Professor John Schaff from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Studio at Northern State University in Aberdeen, political science professor with NSU. Professor Schaff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, lots to talk about today, and perhaps one of the most pertinent topics on a lot of people's mind is the Keystone XL pipeline construction slash protest, as it all interweaves with legislation, recent legislation to prevent what is being called riot boosting. Jonathan Ellis, what's happening this week? Court cases now, so this conversation is moving forward.
Yeah, big day in court with the quote riot boosting legislation getting its kind of a big test. The ACLU filed a lawsuit along with some other organizations, arguing that these laws that the legislature sort of passed at the end of the legislative session, just kind of on the heels of the legislative session, just passed these laws. They're arguing that they violate the First Amendment because they basically allow the state or potentially a third party to sue groups or organizations that quote riot boost and which lead to violence, which of course we saw in North Dakota over the pipeline. So big test for that today. I think it's in Rapid City, and I think it's Judge Pearsall who's hearing that case, and so we should probably get some kind of ruling on this, I would imagine, fairly quickly. And then you got to imagine that there could be some appeals. Regardless, I don't think that we're expected to see construction of the pipeline in South Dakota this year. So this gives it time for this to play out a little bit.
John Schaff, this phrase "riot boosting," where did it come from? Is it something nationwide? Is it it's new on a lot of people's lips?
Well, I certainly think within the context of what we're talking about, it's coming from the experience in North Dakota a couple of years ago at the Standing Rock Reservation protests, and the claim is by some that some of those protesters, including some of the property damage that was done by protesters, was promoted or boosted by outside entities. The idea that, for example, that some people were being paid to protest, or that you had outside agitators encouraging people to engage in certain acts of violence. And I think that's where this is coming from. And when you look at what the bill is talking about, it's talking about when you get groups of three or more people, and then there's somebody being encouraged to engage in certain kinds of activities. Can the state prevent that from happening? And as Jonathan points out, there's an obvious free speech question here, which the ACLU is taking up, and we'll see how that works out.
So one of the things about this lawsuit was that the ACLU filed the lawsuit against Governor Kristi Noem, Attorney General Jason Raunsberg, and Pennington County Sheriff Kevin Toom, and Sheriff Toom said, "Hey, not me, because I just enforce the laws. I don't make them." Jonathan, the ACLU's argument is that as law enforcement officers, they have discretion, similar to, if you pull somebody over for speeding, you don't universally hand out a ticket. There might be extenuating circumstances. What's really behind some of these, people are worried about this, people are preparing for it. Is there a subtext here, Jonathan, that you're seeing beyond the surface?
Well, I mean, going back to the sheriff's claim, I mean, it is kind of it was to me, in my mind, kind of odd that he sort of lumped into this. I mean, obviously the governor's, it was her legislation, and she represents the state, and the AG always represents the state in litigation. I mean, there's been a lot of, quote, subtext to this entire pipeline debate, which has now been going on, for more than a decade. I mean, this pipeline itself has become sort of symbolic of the environmental movement with regard to, you know, the use of future energies. I mean, so this entire pipeline has become a symbol for, you know, future energy use, I guess. You know, the opponents of this pipeline want developing countries, developed countries, to find alternative sources of energy. And you have the argument, others make the argument that, you know, those types of energy uses are far off into the distant future, and we would still need to rely on fossil fuels. And so this pipeline has been an interesting argument for over a decade. You know, it was curious that the first Trans-Canada pipeline that sort of slipped through, nobody even noticed that. So this pipeline has been, many years of debate on this pipeline.
And John Schaff, you mentioned this idea of, you know, outside agitators, trainers, people coming in saying, you know, we will help teach you effective protest methodology, and some of that might be violence. It seems like everybody would be on the same side at preventing violence and preventing people training other people for violent action.
Well, I think that, and this is part of the ACLU lawsuit, I think there's a question about how the law is written and what exactly, where is the line between peaceful protesting and violence? For example, is occupying a certain space an act of violence, even if it's, you know, occupying in violation of the law? Some will look at that as peaceful protest of civil disobedience. Others say that's an act of violence because you've trespassed, you've violated the law. At what point does something go from kind of your standard protest to violence? Though, again, I think what's at issue here is threats of either, you know, bodily violence against people. We saw some of these things in North Dakota of people going after law enforcement, throwing things at law enforcement, or committing property damage against local property holders. And there's the question of how much. At what point does someone encouraging people to this this kind of action, at what point does that stop being free speech, and when does it become incitement to violence? And I think that's part of what the ACLU will argue, is that the law is not written well enough to allow someone to understand which side of the line is which.
And Jonathan, it seems like construction is not currently underway, there's a whole lot of time for not only for these kinds of court cases, but really for law enforcement to gather intel, to pool resources, to get new equipment, to sort of figure out how to deal with keeping people safe and perceiving any threat. Also, a lot of time if you're planning a protest to sort of think about how exactly you want to play that out. How does time, Jonathan Ellis, play into what we might see in South Dakota over construction of this pipeline?
Well, yeah, time will play. I mean, you talk about the protests. I'm reminded of the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle. It was 1999 now, and I was living in the area at the time. And months ahead of that WTO meeting, there were activists in the area where I lived training to incite violence, training to occupy Seattle. And I remember as a freelance writer, I was, reaching out to some magazines, saying, hey, you guys might want to be aware of this. And nobody even blinked. As soon as that thing blew up, I was getting phone calls from people, hey, can you cover this for us? And this is kind of the same thing. You get in certain areas, you do get the sense that there are preparations for this taking place on both sides. You have on the communication side of what TransCanada, TC Energy, there was an issue yesterday about a truck that was supposedly one of theirs on the Cheyenne River Reservation that was escorted off, and we had communications people from them vehemently denying that this was their truck. And so there's on both sides of this, there's preparation for what eventually we anticipate will be this efforts to be put this pipeline in.
Jonathan, with the situation in North Dakota, did you, and, you know, I give away my hand here because it was frustrating on our end to sort of get comments from the oil company or to reach the spokesperson for North Dakota who seemed particularly overwhelmed. Do you think that that's part of an effective strategy for law enforcement is to figure out how to communicate better when things are underway?
Well, yeah. I mean, hey, I'm a communication professional, right? I mean, right. It's always better to be able to kind of, and that goes for both sides. There were incidents where you had the protesters who were, you know, saying that they had been assaulted by, you know, guards, and so it was very difficult. And we had a reporter out there for a while, but it's very difficult to kind of sift through fact and fiction, frankly, and what was going on, unless you actually have people on the ground. And I suspect that if we get to the point now where this pipeline is going to be built here, that there will be media organizations in South Dakota and probably even nationally that will have people on the ground to monitor what's going on.
Mm. All right, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about another court case, and that one has to do with hemp and the 2019 Farm Bill. Jonathan, that's unfolded in Sioux Falls. What do we know today that we didn't know last week?
Well, the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe had filed suit against the Department of Agriculture a couple weeks ago, arguing that USDA has violated the 2018 Farm Bill, which authorized hemp. And within that provision, USDA was required within 60 days to approve state and tribal hemp plans. And so that had not happened. The Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe was, I think, one of eight tribes and states that have already submitted hemp plans with USDA. But USDA has not approved any of those because they argue that they need to first adopt rules and regulations surrounding those plans. And those rules and regulations won't be adopted until later this fall. And so that issue kind of played out because the tribe was asking for a judge to basically order USDA to approve their plan, because the tribe has argued that they've invested a lot of resources and money into planting a 2019 crop. In the end, Judge Karen Schreier sided with USDA and said that, look, before you can have a plan, you need to have regulations in place. And so the tribe, looks like the tribe's attempt now to plant a 2019 crop is not going to happen.
And they're saying, Jonathan Schaaf, there's a lot of money that weighing on, you know, a crop this year versus waiting a little bit, a lot of frustration in South Dakota about the conversation around hemp.
I think we see in this case then our legislature's discussion of the question is we're moving at the speed of bureaucracy, which is pretty slow. You know, we have in public policy studies, there's a phrase called bureaucratic inertia, and a bureaucracy in motion tends to stay in motion. But here we have a bureaucracy at rest, and it tends to stay at rest.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Jonathan's talking about, is that if the USDA has not promulgated the regulations yet, going through the whole administrative procedure to even promulgate a regulation is very time-consuming, and it's very frustrating when you have people, whether in this case tribal, dealing with the USDA or within our own state as we try to pass legislation. It seems pretty obvious that that agriculture in the state of South Dakota is ready to move on hemp, and they're getting thwarted or standing in the way is, well, both legislative and bureaucratic obstacles to that. And so I eventually think this is going to happen, even though the tribe will get what it wants. It's just going to be a year later than what they want. And other than reforming the Administrative Procedure Act, I don't know how you go. I don't know how you go about speeding these things up. And either way, it would be too late for the present controversy.
And Jonathan, and some people still don't even know whether their hemp hand lotion is legal or not. So in the meantime,
Well, that's true. I mean, anything with CBD oil in it apparently is illegal, and I've known people who have just been who've thrown theirs out for fear of being breaking the law. I mean, anyway, it's crazy.
All right, and
I'd hate to be a law enforcement officer charged with policing hand lotion. That'd be unfortunate.
I'm guessing they have a few better things to do.
I sure hope so.
All right, so let's close with a little update from the governor's mansion in Pier. There will be no fence. Jonathan Ellis's fence sounds a little bit like a news story / non-news story. Tell us a little bit about how this unfolded.
Well, word started leaking out that the state was soliciting bids to build a fence around the governor's mansion. It's basically on security. You can just kind of walk all over the place if you want to, which I think is an anomaly in the United States of America. I would guess that most governor's mansions. I'm from Denver, and that mansion has a fence around it. I would guess most of them do, but. Nonetheless, it created a controversy. What kind of fence are we talking about? You know, was it going to be like the kind of thing that they want to put on the Mexican-American border? Was it that kind of thing?
It's a barrier.
There were some concerns. There were some concerns among peer residents that we'd heard from. Like they thought it was going to make the neighborhood look trashy or something like that. In the end, the governor announced that they're not going to put in a fence. It was going to be about, I think, $400,000 to $500,000, presumably a pretty nice fence. But now, apparently, that's not going to come to pass. It was a local controversy in Pier.
Yeah, John Schaff. It seems like that's also a victim or a circumstance of timing added to that conversation, as it evoked other fences.
Yeah, I don't know if they were going to get the Mexicans to pay for it. That would have helped out with that $500,000.
Who says we have to foot that bill?
Yeah. But yeah, this strikes me as, I don't know if I'd call it an on story, but it might be, a bottom story. And I don't know, it depends who you believe. How serious were they about building this fence? And some, you get a sense in some ways they were talking about it and putting some plans, but hadn't made a decision. But then obviously when it was made public, I don't know. It didn't go over real well with the public, and so whether they backed off because they didn't think it was feasible, whether they weren't ready, they didn't want to spend the money, or just because it was sort of embarrassing, I guess we'll never know. It's probably a combination of all those things.
Yeah, it feels like we're trying to keep a little bit of, hey, we don't need that fence here. We're South Dakota. We'll see what happens next.
I think it's edifying that we have a governor's mansion that doesn't have a fence. I hope that we never need to build the fence, and that's that way. Maybe we should be proud that you can, as Jonathan puts it, walk all over the governor's residence.
John Schaff with the Northern State University political science professor, Dr. Schaff. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us from the Tom and Danielle Amen studio at Northern State. Jonathan Ellis, ArgusLeader.com. Follow him on Twitter. Jonathan, thanks. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lori.